we walked in to it and it was just instant, absolutely instant attraction. And it was, this is the most beautiful thing we've ever seen, house we've ever seen. And we can't believe it's even affordable for us, never mind that it exists in the first place. And that was standing in the hall as we walked in the front door. And then as we walked round, it just got better and better. And it was incredible. It was like an amazing moment. And I could completely see myself sitting in there and living there from the moment I walked in the door. It was a wonderful feeling.
Hello there, and welcome to another episode of Homing In. I'm Matt Gibbard, co-founder of The Modern House. My guest on the podcast today is Tim Little, who's owner and CEO of the footwear brand Grenson. At the time of recording, Tim was knee-deep in building works at home, so I polished up my Chelsea boots for a visit to his London studio. As always, I asked him to describe his life story through the lens of the homes he's lived in over the years. I was particularly interested to find out more about his current home, which he bought after seeing it on our website and falling instantly in love. It's a mid-century masterpiece set in splendid isolation near Rye in East Sussex. A celebration of craftsmanship certainly comes through in everything that Tim is about. His father was a textile manufacturer, and he's inherited a fascination with how things are made and the thrill of seeing something take shape on the factory floor. He tells me about his background in advertising, when he was given the most thrilling brief of all time, make Adidas cool again. Having been given the keys to one of the world's most established brands, he was inspired to start his eponymous footwear company and then ultimately take over Grenson. Tim is a really lovely guy. He's very humble and grounded, and I really enjoy getting to know him through the course of this conversation. Happy listening, and I hope you enjoy it. So we always start with your childhood home. Where are you from? You're from the Midlands, aren't you?
So I grew up in the East Midlands. If you fold the map of England, you literally, where I'm from is right in the crack of the map, if you know me. That's probably a good way to describe it. Halfway between Nottingham and Derby. I grew up there, and my father was a lace maker and a textile manufacturer, and that area is famous for textile manufacture. The town that most of my family is from is a town called Long Eaton, which most people don't know. But yeah, so that was the childhood home.
So with your father having that kind of background, were you aware of this idea of manufacture and particularly clothing at a young age then?
Yeah, very much, because running a factory it's very much a full-time thing, in that the factory, I think in the old days, they used to run 24 hours actually. He could never be away from the factory, so I grew up and spent a lot of holidays and a lot of weekends working in the factory and doing various jobs. And it wasn't till a long time after I got involved with Grenson that my wife actually said, do you ever think about the fact that you were in a factory a lot and now you love being in the factory in Rushden at Grenson? And I hadn't really thought about it, but I do. I absolutely love it. And walking onto the shop floor at Grenson takes me back to walking around on a Sunday morning with my dad around the old factory and talking to the people and geeing them up and checking on the production and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I think it's a really important part of my life, the factory.
So is it that sense of a group of people pulling together to make something? Is that what's exciting about it?
Very much so. I think with shoemaking in particular, this group of people have together worked on this thing. It sounds really grandiose, but it does feel like that, and it is a team. And what you realise about a factory as well is most factories are actually a production line. Hmm. What that means is that you can't make a pair of shoes if one of those people isn't there, because there becomes a bottleneck, there becomes a break in the chain. Hmm. So they have to work together. They have to take holidays together. They have to take lunch breaks together. And it creates this kind of mini world where they all do everything together, and you either love that or you hate it. You know, a lot of people have worked for us for 40 years and they don't necessarily do that because they have to, but they actually love that life and they like fitting into a small part of the whole and the whole teamwork thing.
How does it make you feel when people dedicate their whole lives to something that you're in charge of like that?
A huge responsibility, I think. And when you look back at how they would have been treated when they started. Things have changed so much because there's a real responsibility from the owner of a business to look after those people, I think, and to be grateful for what they've done. And they put 40 years of their expertise into making these products and making this brand stronger. And I think there's this enormous responsibility to look after them and be grateful for it. And I think that didn't used to be there in the old days. I think loyalty has to be on both sides of the equation.
So your dad obviously worked very hard by the sounds of it. Did you see much of him as a child?
Yeah, I did, because it wasn't a real... Most of what he did was sell in the UK. The fact that he had a factory and he spent a lot of time there, he did work quite long hours, but he was 2 miles from the from home and came home every night at the same time for dinner, left the same time every morning, and he had a kind of real routine, but it was local. Mm. You know, he'd go to the factory every Saturday morning at the same time. Sometimes I'd walk round with him and just listen to it all going on and everything. So yeah, we spent plenty of time with him, yeah.
And did you get from him a certain work ethic, do you think?
100%, yeah. My mum would always say that they'd go on holiday and she would say, can we go away for 3 weeks or even a month or something? He'd work really hard all year and you don't take that many holidays. He'd never go away for more than 2 weeks. He'd feel guilty about being away from the factory. And so he'd work very, very hard, not take very many holidays. Yeah, so I've completely got that ethic. He was quite religious about his work hours. And I think, yeah, I'm pretty much the same.
Hmm. Is he still around, your dad?
Yeah, he is, yeah. Yeah, wow. He's 85, I think.
Amazing.
Yeah.
What does he make of what you've done?
He's an 85-year-old East Midlander who's not the most emotional man in the world. I think he is emotional, probably internally, but we still shake hands. There's no hugging or anything like that. But he's a wonderful person, and I think he's been to Grenson a few times, and I think he loves it. Going onto the factory floor, you can see him light up seeing the factory again. And I think, yeah, it's one of those things where you'd have to ask him what he might say. Hopefully he'd say he was proud of me, but he's not somebody who's going to throw compliments at me every day.
Yeah, fair enough. What about your mum then? Tell me about your mum. What was she like when you were a child?
She had kids soon after being married. And so she gave up work then. And then she brought us up. And then she did a lot of kind of voluntary stuff from then on. She's still around. And they're not together. She lives in London in Barnes. And so I see her a lot more than him now. But yeah, she's tough. Very internally very strong, very tough person. Kind of nothing phases her at all. And she's one of those get on and get it done. But she's a real source of inspiration for this kind of inner strength of anything can be sorted out. You just keep going and work it out and don't think about yourself too much. I think that was a big thing. She always tells a story of when she was very young, she was like 7 or 8 and quite self-conscious at that time. And she went to a family party at Christmas and she was very shy. And this uncle said to her, what's the problem? The reason you're shy is because you're worried about what people think about you. But let me tell you, nobody's thinking about you. Nobody cares, kind of thing. And it made her think, yeah, that's right. And that kind of shook her into this thing of stop thinking about yourself. Stop worrying about yourself all the time. Look outwards, don't look inwards, kind of thing. And I think that's a bit of her mantra.
So how does that relate to the way that you see yourself? Were you a shy boy? Were you quite confident?
No, relatively confident. I think I'm probably one of those people who I've never had a problem doing stuff and meeting people and going to things. I think, like anybody, a bit of internal kind of nervousness or whatever. There's a term for everything nowadays, so like imposter syndrome or whatever. I think we all have that. Yeah, I do feel walking into a big room of people I don't love, I much prefer seeing people on a one-to-one basis or love like friends for dinner rather than a big party somewhere, kind of thing. But generally I can cope with stuff. I'm not that shy that I don't want to go out.
Yeah. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because you're describing actually both your mum and your dad as they sound very keep calm and carry on type people.
Yeah.
And it's partly generational, isn't it, I think?
Yeah.
But did that leave room for you to feel emotional about things, if you see what I mean?
That's a good question, because I think if you ask my children, they would say I'm quite old-fashioned like that, and a bit more like my mum and my dad. I think I'm a lot different. I've come a long way from where they were.
Yeah.
But nowhere near where my children's generation are, for example.
Mm.
So I think I'm still quite, yeah, just not outwardly that emotional, probably.
Mm. Yeah.
I still feel more comfortable keeping control a little bit outwardly.
Yeah.
And not letting it all go.
Yeah.
So I'm a bit of a control freak in that sense, I think. And also working in the fashion industry, that's much more open, I think, mm. and more emotional, and people talk about themselves a lot more.
Mm.
So I think, yeah, bit by bit, I've moved away from them and towards this bit, hopefully.
But as someone that is naturally quite matter-of-fact about things, actually you've touched on something. You're in an industry, fashion, which is famously not very like that. How do you resolve those two things?
I sit back from it, really.
Yeah.
I'm not comfortable at all about kind of fashion industry events and things like that. We do things like we'll work, say, with Craig Green on doing the shoes for his collection, and there'll be a catwalk show, and I'll go along to that and sit there and watch that and absolutely love watching it, but I don't feel part of it at all.
Mm.
I don't feel really part of that world. I feel a little bit awkward in it. But I think that's quite healthy as well, because I think if you get too consumed in it, in the fashion world, it drags you along in directions that you maybe didn't ought to go. And ultimately, we have a heritage brand with Grenson. We have a traditional brand, and although we've modernised it, and the idea is taking the good stuff from the heritage and getting rid of the bad stuff from the heritage and making it more modern and bringing it up to date, it's still not, we're not in the high fashion world. We're not Balenciaga or anything. I feel very comfortable being in this kind of business versus being in a high fashion brand.
Yeah, that makes sense. How did you get on at school when you were young, out of interest?
I did okay, and I basically had no interest really academically. I just hated the whole process of learning. I was very sporty. I think I managed to stay there by dint of being in all the teams and what have you, and doing a lot of sport for the school and what have you. And I got through what are now GCSEs, were O-levels in my day, and did quite well, got all of them and did okay. Because it's just about the level where you could do the amount of work I was prepared to do and get through them okay with a relative level of intelligence. And then A-levels was that step where you really actually had to knuckle down. And so got to A-levels, did next to nothing, disastrously, they were just appalling. And it jolted me so much, I thought, I've got to work hard. And then in 6 months later, I retook them and did really well in them. And so it was just a work thing. And I just couldn't focus. And to this day, I'm just terrible at things that I'm not interested in. I know everybody says that, but I really am. I just can't be bothered to do things I'm not interested in. I can't focus. And things I really love and really want to do, I throw myself into.
Mm.
So it's not for me, that world, really.
Yeah, you're not the first successful person to say that, but it's always interesting to hear, I think. Were you interested in shoes from a young age? What did you wear?
Yeah, so my mum always tells a story that she used to take me to the Co-op in Long Eaton to get my school shoes. And they had this big wall of shoes. I can remember it this day. It was actually, I'd love to see an old picture of it, because in my mind, it was really beautiful. A wall of shoe boxes with the sliding wooden ladder, and the woman would go up the thing and get the shoes out, bring them down. And my mum always used to tell the story about when it came to shoes, she absolutely dreaded it, because she'd bring the shoes down and, what about these? And I'd say, they're too round, or they're too pointy, or I don't like the lace up, or I don't want the slip on, or whatever it was. And she'd be up and down the ladder. And so there was that kind of early sign, I think. And then most of the fashion when I was a teenager was coming through music and coming through the street. So I went through all of those pretty much, and was quite a chameleon with each of those. Never quite a punk, but I was also a big football fan. One of the first kind of shoes I had to have was a Doc Martin boot, the kind of cherry red boot with the yellow stitching.
And how does that relate to football?
Because the fans used to wear them on the terraces, yeah. And it And it was, you always saw that there's obviously a very dark side to all of that as well in 70s football culture. But all the kind of tough guys at the football matches and everything were always wearing this uniform. And it was always the Doc Martens, and it was a thing about being hard. And at school in those days even, and growing up, it was always a kind of thing about being tough. Masculine and tough, and
yeah.
And that was one of those kind of visual signs. I wear Doc Martin boots, I'm telling you that I'm tough. Of course I wasn't, but
yeah, I had a pair as well. I wasn't tough either.
Yeah. That's a big admission. But yeah, no, Doc Martins, and there was a lot of footwear went along with the punk thing, and then onto other genres after that.
Fast forwarding to you working in advertising, which is how you started out, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I believe that Adidas was one of your clients.
Yeah.
Tell me about that, because I think that was a bit of a light bulb moment for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was huge. I was working in London, and then I got a job in New York and went there for 2 years, and it was a very corporate. My client was Citibank for 2 years. Very corporate, not very creative at all, but it was that kind of Mad Men. It was about entertaining, it was about getting the job done. And then I came back to London to work for the agency that I'd been at before, but at a high level, and it was a small creative agency. And they said, look, we've got this brief in to pitch for Adidas. Do you want to run it? And I said, that's my absolute dream. I'd grown up with Adidas, football boots for football, and then with jeans during the weekend, I'd always wear Adidas Samba or Gazelle or whatever. That was my kind of thing and my brand. And it was, for me, the three stripes was just part of my world. It was so important. And so they said, do you want to pitch for it? So we pitched for it and we won it. And what was happening back then, it was quite interesting because, if anything, the thing that I really do is brands, and I love how brands work and how they grow. And so Adidas had been going along, was the biggest sportswear brand by a million miles. And then along came Nike in the 70s and very quickly had overturned Adidas's dominance. And they'd done it by being irreverent, and their kind of internal tagline was irreverence justified. And so where Adidas would have, say, Gary Lineker, who never got booked and was very sensible and fantastic sportsman, they would always get him. Nike came along, got Ian Wright, who was this irreverent footballer who was winding up the fans and was the new blood, the exciting new irreverent footballer. And by doing this, Nike had completely taken the hearts of the young, who had got excited and thought, fantastic, that my dad wears Adidas, I'll wear Nike. And Nike had completely taken over and become number one. We said, look, this is a worldwide account, and we're 40, 50 people in an agency in Covent Garden. We haven't got an international network. And they said, look, it's so important for us to get this right, we're just going to give the business to whoever's got the right ideas. Then you work it out. So we pitched for it, and the pitch was really simple. It was the most wonderful brief I'd ever had. Normally a brief to an ad agency is 5 pages long and corporate guidelines and all this kind of stuff that you're so bored of by the end, you can't be bothered to write anything good. And Adidas's brief to us was, make Adidas cool again. That was the brief. It
Great.
Was just those words. Mm. And to an agency, that is an absolute dream. And so we set about writing stuff to change the image of Adidas. And from day one, we worked really closely with them internally. I was on a plane at least twice a week to Germany, and occasionally I'd go back and forwards, pick stuff up, come back. So I was in Germany a lot for about 4 years, but I absolutely loved it. And I sat there and I just saw this incredible amount of internal creativity around a shoe.
Mm.
And my job was very much to document the story of a new shoe coming out. And this whole process was just fascinating to me, because I was seeing for the first time, right from the beginning, all the way through to this product being made, and then us doing the advertising, launching it, and then seeing what the sales were and whether it's successful or not. And that completely changed me, because there was part of it was the idea of creativity in shoes. But the other part of it that was really life-changing for me was that I realised I wanted to be doing something from start to finish. Ultimately, I want to do something where I own a brand.
Yeah, absolutely. So you had your eponymous brand, Tim Little.
Yeah.
When did you start that?
1997.
Okay.
So we opened here. So that where you came in earlier, that's the shop. And we opened here in 1997 and, yeah, had about 20 pairs of shoes. We just did the shop to start with. I thought, to have any credibility, I need to have something three-dimensional for somebody to walk into. I remember Nike, when they did the first ever Nike Town, and Phil Knight described it as a three-dimensional advertisement. So I thought, I've got to have a shop to start with to have any credibility. I don't just want to be turning up with a suitcase full of shoes. And I wasn't a shoe designer either at that point. I needed something more substantial for people to get their head around. So we started here in 97.
And then am I right in saying that you recently stepped away from that to focus on Grenson?
Yes. Basically, I got involved with Grenson in 2005, so 17 years ago. And my brand was downstairs, and we used to sell to people like Selfridges and Harrods and Barneys in New York and Saks and people like that. But it was a really nice size. Before Grenson, I loved it because I didn't want to have lots of people. I wanted to keep it about the right kind of size and keep a bit of lifestyle element to it for myself. And then Grenson came along as an opportunity, and very quickly that became a conflict time-wise. So I ended up bringing the Tim Little thing down to just the shop and doing a lot of bespoke and special makes. And we had the collection, ready-to-wear collection. We had a lot of regular customers who had come in, but I stopped really promoting it or driving it. And I thought, I'm just going to close it and focus on Grenson. So we closed it 2 years ago.
So one thing I want to ask you about is your sense of Britishness, because I get the impression that's very important to you. You sent us some pictures of your previous home on the river in Chiswick. And yet, I think I'm right in saying there's a framed Union flag above the fireplace, right?
Yeah.
Talk to me about your pride and what it means to you to be British and how that feeds into your work.
I think we'll start with that flag. I'm not that nationalistic, but that flag was the flag that was flown over my dad's factory. And they flew it over the factory during the war. So they got it during the war, and it's one of those old flags that says British made in the corner.
Yeah.
I got it from my dad and framed it and put it up, and I love that because it ties everything together.
Yeah.
I think, being British is important to me. I really, that feeling, I did my family tree a while ago, and my dad actually got somebody to do it, and they did the family tree, and when you set out on it, you think, there's going to be somebody from here and there. And basically everybody came from this area of about, I think the furthest person, and we got back to 1675. So the first person was in York, and that's like an hour's drive from Nottingham. And they'd gone from York into Lincolnshire, and then from Lincolnshire but into Nottingham, and that was it.
Yeah.
And everybody in this great big family tree thing was from the same area, I can't find anything, any trace of anybody down my mum's side or my dad's side who aren't A, from England, and B, actually from central England as well.
Mm.
So I think you do that and then you think, oh, that's a bit boring. I'd much prefer to have something a bit more exciting than that. And then you think, oh, I'm going to embrace it then. Okay, I'm English, born and bred.
Yeah.
My ancestry is all English. And then when you get involved with something like Grenson, when I started my own business, it was about English shoemaking. And the first line I used to use, not outwardly, but I used to describe it to people, say, well, what's it about? I used to say, it's like English shoes without the cobweb. A lot of the old English shoe companies would have a picture of somebody with half moon glasses knocking nails in the shoe and saying beautiful craftsmanship. And I would say, I want all of that craft, but not with all of that dusty old attitude. I want to modernise it. So it was right from the beginning, there was Englishness in the thing about English shoemaking. And then obviously I got involved with Grenson. And one big thing about it was Englishness. The main type of footwear that we do, the construction, is called Goodyear Welted. I won't bore you to death with that, but the British construction is less about what it looks like and more about it being solid and lasting a long time and almost being quite heavy and chunky and quite rugged. And I love this about, this is what Grenson, a big part of Grenson, is Goodyear Welted, this Englishness, and we're going to do that. It's about being down to earth. My favourite thing is I found this old Gretzen tagline from the 30s, which we brought back, and it's their tagline was the good shoe. And I love that because it's not the best shoe in the world or the greatest, it's just the good shoe. And it's that feeling of, it's just a good shoe. That's all you need to know. And I think that's the Englishness in it. That's a very long-winded answer about English, but I think you tapped into something
there. But actually, your Britishness also feeds into your furniture, by the looks of it, because you've got some Robin Day dining chairs and some reclining chairs, by the looks of it.
Yeah.
So what do you think about the things that you respond to in that realm, and more in the kind of interiors and furniture realm, because it looks very British as well?
Yeah, and I think the same thing. I think Robin Day, just reading a little bit about how he used to design, and it was all about making something that worked. It was about a chair had to be comfortable, it had to be practical, it had to be relatively easy to manufacture, it had to be relatively inexpensive. And so it was practicality, and we've got these set of kind of Robin Day dining chairs, and to a lot of people they look quite odd. So they've got black leather cushioned seat, metal legs, and then these kind of almost a bit like this wood here, sweeping wooden arms. And they do look slightly quirky, but I think every single element of that chair is done for practicality. And there's a real beauty in that. I know that's been said a million times, but
I think it's true though. I mean, I agree with you. It's a utility and beauty together. Yeah. That's the magic formula. It's very difficult to do.
Absolutely. 100%. So yeah, I think that's similar to what I feel about shoemaking and Gretzen and what have you. A lot of that goes through furniture and interior stuff as well.
Just leaving the podcast very briefly to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Vitsu. The Homing In podcast is obviously all about exploring people's life stories. And what's amazing about Vitsu's 606 universal shelving system is that people carry it with them throughout their lives. It's literally a physical backdrop to their past, their present, and their future. They might inherit some Vitsu shelving from their parents, for example, and then take it with them when they move. The joy of Vitsu shelving is that it becomes a receptacle for the things that matter most in our lives. So our favourite books, photos, found objects, kids' paintings, and so on. You wouldn't have thought it's possible to form an emotional attachment to some shelving, but that's exactly what happens. In my experience, it's the one thing that people refuse to part with when they sell their home. To find out more about it, visit vitsoe.com. That's vitsoe.com. Right, back to the podcast.
So Tim, I'm dying to move on to the present day because I want to talk to you about the house that you bought through us at the Modern House, which is, goes down as one of the best I think we've had on the books over the years.
But that's great to hear.
Yeah, it's an absolute beauty, I think. I've never been there. I look forward to the invite, but
yeah.
It's a 1960s house near Rye in East Sussex called White Fox Lodge.
Yeah.
What did you think when you first went there, the first time you visited on a viewing?
I love property and addicted to, I'm not just saying this, but I'm addicted to the Modern House. And we were thinking about buying somewhere out in the country. And I saw that house on the Modern House and thought, I love this. But before going anywhere, I always do like loads of research, looking it up, and a lot of time on Google Maps and where's the neighbours and all that kind of stuff. So it was more about whether I just loved that house, whether Julia and I'm saying Julia and I loved that the house.
Sorry, Julia.
No, you'll kill me. But we walked in to it and it was just instant, absolutely instant attraction. And it was, this is the most beautiful thing we've ever seen, house we've ever seen. And we can't believe it's even affordable for us, never mind that it exists in the first place. And that was standing in the hall as we walked in the front door, and then as we walked round it just got better and better, and it was incredible. It was like an amazing moment, and I could completely see myself sitting in there and living there from the moment I walked in the door. It was a wonderful feeling. And then the secondary feeling is that once you decide, okay, I really, really want this house, the second thing is you then start to get practical and think about what work needs to be done on it. And that's where it was very sobering, because I was surprised how low the price was of it for for what it was. And I realised why it was that the whole building had been built in the 1960s. It was completed in 67, I think. And it hadn't been touched since then. So it was built by an advertising guy called Sidney Horniblow, Sidney and Joan Horniblow. I mean, it's like a kind of carry-on film or something. It's, like, it's wonderful. And he had a big Rolls Royce and he retired from advertising and this was his retirement house. And he came down, built this house from scratch. The story was that he said he wanted a bungalow and he said to the designer, to the architect, I want a Georgian bungalow, which is the most weird brief. And this architect was a big fan of the Frank Lloyd Wright and Miles van der Rohe and all that kind of thing, and persuaded him to have this new modernist type of building, and persuaded him and his wife Joan. And so they went for it. And this house, they'd built it. It was super modern at the time. So, for example, there's a built-in music system that still works. And there are speakers in the bedroom, the dining room, and the main sitting room. And you can, it, like a kind of early Sonos, there's a button that you can either have them in all three, two, or one.
Does it still work?
It still works, yeah. Still works. And I use it all the time. Record player, radio. The radio's a bit tricky. And the beautiful, all built in. Everything was built in. Everything was bespoke made for that house. The cupboards, the detailing was absolutely gorgeous. But it hadn't been touched. So it was like literally a museum to the 1960s modernist architecture. But all of the infrastructure, so this enormous flat roof, which was falling apart, leaking. We were saucepans everywhere when it rained, terrified every time there was a big rainstorm or whatever. And then everything, the plumbing, the electrics, the whole thing. And everything was a little bit tatty. So we suddenly realised this gorgeous, amazing house was more affordable because it needed all this work doing to it. And we just went for it. And just, it's been the best thing we've ever done.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. I think it's a life-changing type of house somehow. I don't know why I say that. I've never ever lived in a house that didn't have a neighbour. Our house in Chiswick was a semi-detached, neighbours both sides and everything, and we now live in East London and neighbours everywhere. And I've never lived in a house where there are no neighbours. You can't even see a neighbour. It just feels. That's an amazing feeling. To be able to go down there and a whole weight lifts off our shoulders when we walk in and we feel in this space for the first time ever, where we just feel completely relaxed and alone, actually. And it's a really lovely feeling. It feels like all the intensity of life disappears when you go there.
It's really lovely.
And this amazing history of the house. I spent hours on the internet looking up the architect who designed it. What else did he design?
Yeah, because he's a guy called John Schwert.
Yeah. And I think this house was the kind of pinnacle for him. So he did a few government buildings, council buildings and schools, I think, all of which had interesting elements to them. But I think this was the one project where he was allowed to do exactly what he wanted and did his dream house. And it's a triumph. The space is incredible. It works on this pinwheel kind of system. So you have a wing. It's like a wing. It sounds a bit grandiose, but a wing which is the main bedroom. Master bedroom, if you like, and dressing room. And then there's another kind of pinwheel over here, which is like a guest suite. And there's little bedrooms, three bedrooms there and a bathroom. And they come into a central thing with a fountain and a... I'm making it sound a lot more grand than it is. And
then sounds like Versailles.
But,
fountains,
yeah, exactly.
Wings.
Well, seeing as you've invited yourself, well, you'll see it for yourself in a minute, but when it's done. But yeah, just the space and where you walk, and everything works beautifully space-wise.
Yeah.
So that room there, which needs to be a bit quieter, is just off there, and you come around the corner, and then there's a dining room the next thing. And the workspace in the kitchen, the way that's done, very difficult without showing.
I know exactly what you're describing. And tell me about the light in there, and also how you experience the sort of changing seasons, because you must go there at different times of year as well.
Yeah, the light's incredible. In the evening, as we look across the fields, you get to sunset in the evening.
Amazing.
and the sunsets are incredible. They're wonderful.
You're slightly elevated, aren't you? Is that right? It looks like it's elevated. Or maybe
yes. Yeah. Yeah. So it's by the Tillingham Valley. So all the fields gently drift away down into the valley in front of us. So you get this lovely view, but you can't see it from anywhere either. It's very clever the way they've done it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, through the seasons it changes. And there's something really nice about having all this glass, because the main feature is two-thirds of the walls are glass, sliding doors. Mm. And in the winter, you think that's a summer thing, but actually it's really beautiful in the winter when it's dark and rainy and stormy and you're in this house and you're warm and you've got the fire on and you can see it all going on out there and all the wind and the blustery, but you're sat in this cosiness and feeling that kind of protection from it.
It's also nice to get that low winter light, isn't it, that penetrates quite deep into a house, I think.
Yeah, you lots of shadows and in the evening you start to get colours on the wall and everything. Mm. Yeah, very much so. I think it, you know, ultimately, it's a bit of a cliche, but by having floor-to-ceiling glass everywhere, it completely connects you with what's outside. Because everywhere you look, you're looking at the garden and the field beyond. And as the seasons change, you're watching all of that.
Tell me about how you've furnished it. And is it a period piece inside?
So we're in the middle of renovating it. So we've got some furniture there, and then we'll do more as time goes on. And I think we're very much want to keep it in tune with the 1960s, with that mid-century feel. And I think it'll be a bit of a mixture of a few kind of older pieces. And I quite like the idea of furniture that is modern, but its influence is clearly mid-century. Mm. We don't want the house to be a museum to the 1967. We want it to be a kind of modern version, almost as if that architect built that house today. We'll keep all of the original features that are built into the house, absolutely, but then the bits that we put into it are what would Sidney Horniblow have done if he was moving in there now, maybe.
Yeah, today's carry-on film.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't have a Rolls Royce, but an Audi will have to do. But he, one of the big briefs to him was that the Horniblows were collectors of art and they were into their art. And one of the big briefs to him was, we want a house where we can display all the art. So there's lots and lots of big white walls.
Oh, great.
There.
Well, on that subject, you've got a lot of photography, haven't you?
Yes, I'm a bit obsessed with photography. I buy, or have in the past, bought quite a lot of prints. There's a guy called Terry Cryer who in the 50s was a photographer who mainly photographed portraits of jazz and blues musicians in London. And I started collecting a lot of his stuff and I absolutely loved them. So yeah, I'm a big fan of photography. I'm slightly nervous of art. I'm not that confident. There are things I absolutely love. A lot of things I love I could never afford, like Mark Rothko and things like that. But I'm slightly nervous about the things I can afford, whether they're any good, and being confident
enough. Yeah, I get
that.
Yes, exactly, because you do. Yeah, I know what you're saying. To buy a sort of contemporary abstract expressionist painting is a bit of a stab in the dark, isn't it?
Totally.
Because you could be wasting your money horribly.
Yeah.
But I think that's the key thing about art. You have to just buy what you like and not worry about the rest of it in a way.
Yeah.
I always think.
Absolutely. That's the key, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. How old are your children?
My eldest is 28. She's a midwife in Margate. And my middle daughter is 25. She's works for Grantson in marketing.
Oh, right.
And my son is 22, nearly 23. And he's living in LA trying to become an actor. So he's done.
Oh, wow.
He did 3 years acting school in New York. And he's just headed off to LA. He's actually coming back next week for the first time in almost a year.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, all doing completely different things.
Just looking at that through the lens of the home for a moment, what's it like for you as a parent now not having them around?
Wonderful. Yeah.
Cut.
Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. No, we always kind of saw, in a fairly boring way, we always saw our lives in three chapters almost.
Okay.
Pre-kids, our adult lives, pre-kids, during kids, and post-kids. Mm. And we always knew that we had to be excited about the post-kids bit.
Mm.
But that's the time we can really, because during the kids bit is absolutely wonderful, but it's a completely different world.
Yeah, you're in the trenches.
You're in the trenches. Mm. Your life isn't fully your own. You can steal bits of time to go away together without them. And you can do that. Weekends are all. And then, but to embrace that third chapter when they've moved on is really important. And it was always important to us. And we made a point of looking forward to it. And we do. And it's really important to us that we see plenty of them. But we do love, doing our own stuff. Really do.
So buying this house in East Sussex, it sounds like that's a kind of emblem of this third chapter in a way. Is that a fair comment?
Very much so. That's exactly what it was. We were thinking about they're going to be leaving. What we'd love to do is we always had this house in Chiswick, which we always thought was the perfect compromise. It was close enough to London to be London, but it was in a suburb, so we had a bit of a garden and it was nice and we felt, we weren't right in the thick of it.
Yeah.
But then we thought when they leave, we could sell that house and get somewhere in right in the centre of London, and I mean right in the centre, where you walk out to almost anything that you do. You can either jump on a 10-minute bus or walk there, and then a place in the country where you can go, let's go there for 3 days and I'll work from there and we'll have a bit of space.
Perfect.
So it was very much part of that. And also having that place in Rye is very much a place where if it's nice enough, they'll want to come. Mm. And I always think a house is a great way of attracting your children back when you want them to come back.
Yeah, oh, definitely, exactly.
If it's right and they love coming, then it's a kind of little magnet for them to keep coming back. And and I think it will definitely become that. They've fallen in love with it. So
that's really good to hear.
Yeah.
Obviously, we asked you to think about your home of the future or a dream space as well. And you've chosen something that's not dissimilar, actually, obviously, to the house that you've bought. But let's talk about this. So it's the Kaufman House in Palm Springs, designed by Richard Neutcher, of course, in the 1940s. But I think specifically it's the Slim Aarons photograph, right, that kind of grabs you, called Poolside Gossip.
Yeah.
So for those people that don't know the house or the photograph, just how would you describe it?
So it's a famous Slim Aarons photograph, and he was famous for photographing the rich in their environment. And this house is one of his most iconic photos. It's shot from the end of the swimming pool, looking down the swimming pool to the house at the end. It's in Palm Springs. It's a classic mid-century, amazing, beautiful house.
Yeah.
And I bought this photo years ago and had it on the wall and been looking at it for years and years. And the more you look at a photograph of something like that, and the photograph is not just the house and the pool, but it's these people who have gathered for a party and they're chatting and having this lovely drinks party by the pool, at the end of the pool. There's a bit of kind of mid-century furniture around and they're all wearing gorgeous, glamorous 60s clothes. And it's a lifestyle thing. It's not just about the house, but it's this whole warm weather, Palm Springs, this feeling of luxury, this feeling of this perfect kind of lifestyle, which of course is not achievable. And when you read about the photo, it was actually a setup. It wasn't, you think you're encroaching on this amazing situation, but he phoned the owner of the house and said, I want to take a photo. Will you get a party together and this afternoon? And she got all some of her friends together, opened a few bottles, and he got the photo. So it's a bit of a setup, but looking at it from afar, it's just, I dream of that kind of lifestyle.
I think it's really interesting, is it, this, because this feeds into the power of photography for me, because you were saying it's a setup. I think the most famous photograph of modernism is that Julia Shulman photograph of the Pierre Koenig case study house in LA.
Yeah.
Which is a sort of dusk shot, isn't it, of that sitting room fully glazed, and then you can see the streetlights twinkling below.
In the background.
Exactly. And that wasn't a deliberate photograph, but I'm fascinated that this single image can conjure up a whole way of living and essentially epitomise modern LA. And I think that this photograph that you're talking about does exactly the same thing with that desert modernism.
Yeah.
You look at it and you feel warm.
Yeah.
And you feel glamour.
What's quite interesting about it as well, which I've only just thought about, is I ended up buying the house in Rye, which is almost a mirror image of that house. It's very similar type of house. So maybe when you said, what were your feelings when you walked into that to Rye the first time? I guess I'd had 15 years of staring at that photo, thinking that's where I want to live. And then you deliver that up to me. I'm like, that's it. Thank you.
That's a great connection to have made. And what I love about meeting you and talking to you actually is that, I don't know, with what we do with the Modern House and with Inigo, we talk a huge amount about the emotion behind people's homes, and actually the reason that you're compelled to buy yourself a new house or a new flat is because it, in your mind's eye, it conjures up this different way of living. It's like a chance to reinvent yourself somehow, isn't it? And that's the thrill of it. And actually, you've genuinely done that. I mean, what you said is it adds massive value to your life. How would you summarize that? How would, if you could put that into words, that sort of feeling of what it's done for you, what would you say?
I think that the houses that we live in are completely a huge part of our makeup. I'm talking about Julia and I. I'm not talking about everybody. People might feel differently. But from our point of view, that the space that we live in, where it is, what it looks like, how we interact with people in that space is a huge part. I can't put a percentage on it, but it's huge. In the way that Grenson's a huge part of my life, the houses are massive to us. And when the... just to compliment you for a minute, before the Modern House, there was nowhere you could really go. You'd have to really search to find these inspirational buildings that you could look at and think, I could, God, look at this. Imagine being in there. Isn't it beautiful the way that looks out on that and the way that's done? And now you can, and that's very important to us, creating these spaces that we want to live in and that can completely change our lifestyle. For example, we live in this house in Spitalfields, which is an old Huguenot house, and the bottom corner is the shop, which is slightly weird, but we've got the little pretty little Grenson shop on the corner, and then upstairs is our house. It's beautiful inside. It's very Dickensian, I guess. And we're doing it so that the top floors are like an apartment almost, like a bedroom and sitting room and everything. And then the ground floor and the floor above can be used communally, so we do lots of stuff through Grenson events or dinners or entertaining people and stuff like that. We want to bring a lot of our work stuff into our lives a bit closer. When we were in Chiswick, a lot of my work stuff was in East London, and our private lives were on the other side of London. And being on the other side of London really does fit. When it's an hour and a bit to get from one side to the other, you don't mix them at all, really. You go home and I'm at home and that's nice. But for the London bit, we want to change our lifestyle completely and really bring kind of the work and the business into it a bit more.
So one of the things I was going to ask you, and you're sort of answering that, is how does the needs of your living space change as you get older? And it sounds like you're saying once the children have grown up and have their own homes, there's actually a hankering for maybe returning to a bit more social life and perhaps your work coming to the fore again, in a sense.
Yeah,
that's really interesting,
so.
I think.
But bringing work and life together.
Yeah.
And also for Julia. Julia did a degree recently, a textile degree at Chelsea. And she's starting to develop that now, her art more. But it's really nice for her to be part of the Grenson thing as well, and she really enjoys that and has met a lot of people through it.
Is Julia an artist? Is that how she described herself?
She would. I think she's like probably not brave enough to use that word on herself, but she is. I mean, she's wanted to do it all her life and has done other things. Her and her sister used to have two toy shops in Barnes and Richmond, and she's wanted to do it all her life, and now she's doing it, but she's at that stage where she's just finished the degree and now she's doing her stuff.
That's amazing.
And probably doesn't feel brave enough to say that. I don't know. She probably listen to this and think, why did you say that?
Yeah,
that's ridiculous.
I get that. No, yeah, it feels like a big deal, doesn't it, the word artist?
But it was the same for me. I wasn't trained as a designer, and saying it was a long time before I'd say I'm a shoe designer. Having done thousands of shoes, it was still like, I wasn't trained, I didn't go to Cordwain. But the same, I think with an artist, it's even more so, probably.
Yeah. What's the dinner party chat for you then, if I'm sat next to you and I say, what do you do? Are you a shoe, I bet you're an entrepreneur, right, don't you think?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. Yeah, I love business, I really enjoy business, and particularly small business, but I love reading about business. Yeah, Shoe design is just part of it. With a business like Grandson, you're manufacturing, selling, marketing. There's so many elements to it. The design bit is probably the bit I love the most, but I don't spend enough time doing it. You know, I do it in little chunks.
You sound similar to me in a way, I would say, in that for me, I've always had some two obsessions in a way. One, I think, has definitely been the brand element. And you said earlier, it was a really interesting challenge with Grandson to take something that was a very traditional brand and haul it kicking and screaming into the current ages. And that's such an interesting challenge, I think. And then also you've talked a lot as well early in the podcast about the people involved. And I feel the same. It's an amazingly gratifying thing to be able to create an environment where people can come and flourish and really find their feet and grow into themselves and grow through the company. That's amazing. I think that's kind of why you do it.
Yeah, it is interesting. I don't know if you find it as well, but we then find as well where two people have met at Grandson and then become really good friends and maybe left. And there's this kind of community of people who get together, people who have left and people who are still here who get together for drinks and stuff. And it's a nice feeling. And I'm sure the same at the Modern House, that there's this kind of created, not just a brand, a culture that people have been in and out of and feel forever it's part of their life.
Yeah, it's people's lives. It's amazing. It's a really lovely thing that you can create this culture where people can come together in that way.
Absolutely.
And thinking about you and Julia then moving into sort of older age, do you think you've got more moves in you? Do you think you'll continue this obsession with buildings that you've got?
No, I don't think so. I think Rye is forever. Absolutely, definitely. That's the kind of place that we've been looking for all our life, probably. I think maybe in London, where we're at, this house in Spitalfields, you couldn't be in a more noisy, aggressive area. We're right on the corner of the Truman Brewery, where at 11 o'clock every night, they throw everybody out from all the pubs and they all come out and they all congregate and try and get cabs outside our house. I think as time goes on, we might get tired of that. We love it at the moment. We absolutely love it. We always thought about when we get really old, the ideal is those kind of Manhattan. You see these kind of people who live in a doorman building in Manhattan in a beautiful apartment, and all your deliveries get done by the doorman and people look after you, and you call if the tap doesn't work, you call the super and he sorts it out. We thought, I don't know if that exists much in London, but we thought when we get a lot older and need a bit more help or something, we'd probably look for that kind of thing. Yeah.
So final question for you, Tim. When you do get to this point later in life and you're settled and you're still in Rye and you're looking back over everything, what do you think is going to give you the biggest sense of satisfaction, do you think?
In life generally, I think just getting there. Do you know what I mean? I think it feels more and more difficult just to put one foot in front of the other sometime. But I have this little mantra thing myself, which is, it's so simple. It's just, Julia always quotes that I say, which is just keep going. And it's not about achieving anything, or it's just about getting through it and enjoying it as much as you possibly can. That's what we try and enjoy every moment. Again, horrible cliche, but we've given up with the kind of idea of achieving something incredible or what have you, and just trying to enjoy what we do, everything, even the difficult things at Grandson or the difficult things with COVID, or try and embrace them and enjoy them. And I think, we go to this place in Ibiza, and at the end of the kind of garden, there's the sea, and there's this little boat that goes by on the hour, at 10 past the hour, every hour. And it never stops. It's a little white boat with a red, it's a little ferry thing, tiny little ferry. And it never stops. It doesn't matter what's happening in the world, this little ferry just chugs along. And that's my thing. I have a picture of it on my phone. And it's just keep going and just keep moving on. And that's it. It's just really down to you to make the best of it and enjoy what you're doing and crack on.
Fab. Thanks so much, Tim. I really enjoyed that. Really did.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, you're a very good interviewer.
Thank you very much.
You
were great.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that. Thank you so much for being here, as always. If Tim's description of his mid-century house in Rye has piqued your interest, do head over to our website and you'll find some photos of it on there. We'll put a link in the show notes. Do please follow the show if you haven't already done so. And we'd, of course, be very grateful to anyone who can find the time to give us a quick rating or a review. This episode was produced by Hannah Phillips and edited by Oscar Crawford. The music is by Father. Thanks again for listening, and talk to you on the next one. Bye-bye.